And every time I would go to these protests, I would feel like an outsider. Like, I didn't know what was happening. I saw them as like just a group of people walking. I didn't quite understand how to contribute.
Welcome to Zetnopod. On the microphone, Tanja Luchsinger, and on the chair opposite me here in my office in Oerlikon, we have Paridhi Gupta. Paridhi is a Swiss Excellence postdoctoral fellow, currently working at ESEC Ethnologie in Zurich. Hi Paridhi, let's dive right in, shall we? So first question, what is your research topic?
Hello everyone, and thank you Tanya for interviewing me. I work with feminist social movements, and in my doctoral work, I looked at four movements. One was a student movement called Prinja Tor, or Break the Cage. The second one was a left women's organization. The third is the Delhi Queer Pride, which is the manifestation or the march of the queer movement. And the fourth is the Shaheen Bagh movement, which was a recent movement against the stripping of citizenship rights of the minorities in India. So these were the four movements I looked at. I looked at them specifically in the capital of India, which is New Delhi. And the reason for doing that is my familiarity with the city of Delhi. I knew the space of Delhi. I knew the geography of Delhi. So that was the reason that I chose that space, because I was familiar with it. And I was familiar with some of the protests that were happening in Delhi already. So it also gave me an easier access to these groups. And the idea was that I look at the strategies they use to organize and mobilize. What do they do to create a march? Or how do they march? And how do these strategies affect or interact with the public space of the movement, which is the street often, or the public square, or a public park? Like, what is the relationship between these two things? And why I wanted to look at this interaction is because we assume that it's a homogeneous space. And my hypothesis was that it's not, that it's gendered, and also like there are internal mechanisms with which the space works. And I looked at it through visuals. Because again, as anthropologists, we do a lot of interviews. I wanted to also introduce a non-verbal way of doing this. And so I looked at visuals, I looked at posters, I looked at banners that they created, and I looked at the street art that they created, and what did these symbols mean? What was it like to carry these symbols in the public space? Because when you're carrying these symbols in the public space, that means you're announcing to the world where you are. And as a woman or as a marginalized gender identity, you're already quite threatened. And holding these symbols means being threatened more. So how do you interact with the space carrying this threat always on your body? The second thing visually I did was develop my own method, which is called visual cartography, which is where participants and activists created maps. And that's especially important in understanding the interaction between space and strategies people use. Because a lot of time it is unconscious. The way we sit or the way we walk in a place, we are unconscious of it. But once they draw the map, they kind of realize, oh, there is a pattern to it. And so that's what they did. They drew the maps, they would draw the street, and through it we would understand how space was constructed, how the protest space was occupied. And through that I was able to gauge how different people would often occupy the same space differently based on their identities. And what this relationship can lead us further into guessing is how a feminist identity is formed and how a space is then created out of that identity. One affects the other. So that's what I would say broadly my research is.
Could you maybe give us an example?
So for instance, we assume often that a protest space is a monolith. We see it as a group of crowd. We see it as a group of people walking. But there are patterns to it, where people choose to walk and the positions people choose to walk. For instance, if in a march people choose to walk in lines, or if they walk in a group, like as a mass, there is a reason for it, which we do not know. And often in protest marches as well, different groups get formed, which are different zones get formed. like this is the zone of a group, or this is the zone where the medical aid is located, or a zone where more experienced participants would be. So as outsiders, we are unaware of this, of these internal cultures of a protest. Even activists themselves, they are not very consciously aware of it when you ask them questions. But somehow when they draw it on the map, it becomes very clear because they've drawn these different zones. And then I can ask them about it, what each zone represents. And in my research, I often found that even in the most liberal spaces, there are gendered aspects to it. There are ways that men occupy these spaces of protest as opposed to how women occupied them. Or for instance, how the presence of men made women walk in a certain way in a march. So that's what the map reveals.
How did you end up researching this particular topic and what motivated you to do it?
It's actually quite personal. This research was very, very personal for me because I identified as a feminist at a very young age. But as you grow older, you start questioning it. What does it mean to be a feminist? Especially if you're not participating in any active move towards destroying patriarchy or any active feminist protest. If you're not doing that, it also feels you're pretending to be one, but not really doing anything for the cause. And you're every day feeling the immense pressure of patriarchy. What are you as a person doing to make it better? And I don't come from an activist family. I don't have the cultural training of an activist. And every time I would go to these protests, I would feel like an outsider. Like I didn't know what was happening. I saw them as like just a group of people walking. I didn't quite understand how to contribute. Like, is carrying the poster enough? Can I be part of the slogans? How does everyone know these slogans? It always baffled me that when somebody starts a slogan, everyone else follows with the next line. How do they know it? And there was some sort of an alienation and this will to combat it. And it was at an opportune time because I live very close to Delhi University, which is a public university in India. And at that time, during the start of my doctoral research, a very huge women-led student movement started against discriminatory hostel policies. And these were gendered, where women were literally locked in their hostel rooms after like 8 p.m. and 6 p.m. and they were not allowed to get out. So they started this movement against it. I was basically like 2 kilometers away from it and I just started visiting it. So I think a lot of things fell into place. And a lot of it was personal motivation to understand protest cultures of feminism, to find my own self as a feminist. But the more I researched, it sort of became a broader agenda to visibilize movements, but also help in increasing movement participation for other women like me who were just scared to like go to a movement because the media images of a movement, especially right now in a very antagonistic environment, is often where there is lots of police, where there's lots of violence, where there are arrests. It's a very threatening image. And I don't think the 18-year-old me would have been comfortable going to a protest like that. Through my research, what I want to do is bust that myth that it's a dangerous place. It's a place of positive affirmation. It's a place of politics. It's a place of finding your own self. And that's what kept me motivated throughout my research.
Very interesting, actually, and a nice motivation. You maybe already said it a little bit, but what are important insights you gained through your work and your continuous engagement with this topic?
One of the important things is that I want to, of course, like create this idea that it's a safe space, but I don't want to be all positive about it as well. Not want to be, but I cannot be, because the evidence says otherwise, the data says it otherwise, the interviews say it otherwise, that it's not all a liberal space. Not all is well in that world as well, because precisely because what I said, it's a gendered space too. There are gendered interactions within this space. There is heterogeneity within this space of protest. And one of the major insights is that it's an imperfect space. And you cannot go into a movement expecting it to be perfect. And in my study, I show that as well, that there are flaws in these movements that don't make them less relevant. But it's also a caution. It is also a reminder that you need to be careful within these spaces as well. There have been cases of harassment in movements. There have been cases of internal politics where marginalized communities are silenced or are not given that much visibility, especially in something like LGBTQ movements, where the elite take much more space, or some of my initial interviews show how the gay men take more space than lesbian women in these very public protests, at least. So these were some of the insights that these movements are important, but they're not perfect. So I think that's the most important insight. The second insight as an ethnographer and as an anthropologist, I would say, is the value of experimentation. Because when I began this research, I knew that I would take interviews, but I didn't know what more I would do. And I was taking interviews, and then the process of cartography is something I developed in the middle of my research. I just came across it because I couldn't understand what they were talking about, and I asked them to just draw it for me. And that sort of led to this creation of this, what I think is a beautiful, beautiful mechanism of activists drawing their hearts out, because I like how their eyes light up when they draw, like holding colorful pens and then talking about it and then discovering something new about something they've been a part of for so long. So I think that's another important insight, that one should be open to experimenting with methods, especially in our doctoral work. I think we should be very open to experimentation and sort of taking risks with the kind of methods and theories we use.
That's a really good advice, actually. Which cliches or stereotypes do you encounter regularly about your work, either in the field or as well outside of it?
First is, of course, why would I even need to research social movements? Because there's been enough research on social movements. Because at least within the field, there is always the need to fill a gap, right? Like, so what is this gap that I'm filling? And I would say the gap that I'm filling is of innovative methods which we could use to do this research. Another cliche that's very, very common is that a protest is just a mob. It's just people who have no other jobs just coming together. That is not well thought out. And if it's thought out, it's a terrorist attack or a conspiracy. Like a small-scale student-led protest cannot be something with layers of ideology, or it cannot be something that's organized to the level of space. Like, that's not something that people think about. And it might not be organized very consciously, but there are cultures that people learn through years of participation and through looking at participation of others. And spaces organize themselves, and people organize themselves in that space accordingly. So that's another very usual cliche that I wanted to buzz, that it's not just a group of people walking together for no reason. There is a reason for it, and there is a pattern to it. And that pattern repeats historically. For instance, say that if you stand at the back of a protest, it's much more dangerous because the police gets access to you first. So it's something that people within the movement who've been part of it would know. But would you, as an outsider who's going for the first time, know? No, you wouldn't. So these are another cliche that I faced very like regularly. And thirdly, of course, I talked about it before as well, that the other end of it, that it's a utopia, that it's the perfect place, that it's all positive and happy in that space. And everything a movement does, at least a feminist or one of these social justice movements, whatever they do is absolutely perfect in its politics, that it's not criticizable. That's another myth, or like that's another active cliche that I see, that my research sort of busts, that it's not all perfect. Again, like emphasizing it's necessary, but it's not perfect.
Connected to your research topic, what are things you would want to tell or introduce into, let's say, politics or also practice, like outside of academia?
One is, of course, I would want social movement research to be much more accessible, because I feel, especially this kind of research about politics, it needs to be accessible to people outside of academia. So what I would want to do is to write about it and talk about it in a much more publicly accessible manner, where the insights from these research is available to activists who are not academics, or like young women who just want to find their feminist identity. I have several ideas, like just creating like a workbook of things you should do in a protest, or like protest for dummies, you know, something like that, basically like an amateur book, which lets you know this is a safe way to access a protest. Because I feel like this idea of putting your body on the line which a protest has, that if you're not threatened enough, you're not committed enough. It excludes a lot of people. It excludes the disabled. It excludes the chronically ill. It excludes who are immunocompromised. It excludes who are just scared but want to. You know, it excludes young people. So why have that as a requirement? So I would want to like create that document that says, this is how you can do this safely. You can participate in politics safely. So I would want to revive that idea and bring that outside academia. So those are the two things I would say I would want to do.
I'm wondering, like, how would a normal day of field work for you in your field look like?
Initially, I was carrying a recorder and my tiny web camera until I realized it was not feasible because you were always under threat and also people didn't trust you so much with it. And then I shifted to just using my phone for everything. But it meant like going from morning till noon to these places and sort of just silently observing. So there were some forms of participant observation along with interviews within it. I would note things down immediately in a notepad. And it also meant some reciprocity and some accountability from my end, because I also often felt very guilty about taking time off these activists, right? Because they're protesting for a cause and you're like, hey, give me an interview. It kind of felt not fair because they're anyway doing this free labor for a free society for all of us. And you're going in the middle of that for your research. It just seemed at least to be petty until I was contributing in some way to the protest. So I tried being there at least time-wise, devote some time to them. If they needed something, I tried to give it to them. And that also meant conforming to their erratic schedules. So I had to be there continuously because they could find time at any point of time, right? They could find like 5 minutes now and then 15 minutes in the evening. So that's what it meant. It also just meant opening about myself more and more, because right now, especially, these are dangerous places. Because there is so much antagonism from the state towards them, they do not trust outsiders. And I'm pretty much an outsider. I am not part of any political organization. I have not been part of activist circles. So they did not immediately trust me. Of course, my student identity gave me some access, but that's about it. So it also like meant that a lot of time was just spent on rapport building and just talking about myself, becoming some semblance of acquaintance, if not friends. Like, I wouldn't say I'm friends with people I've worked or like I've talked to, but acquaintances, they know a lot about my life and my personal life as well.
So then you would just go there, probably sit in the street with them, have chai with them, have something like that?
Yes, go to the street with them, have chai with them, have food with them. And some days they were like no interviews at all. Some days it was just entirely doing this or like running around with them or just accompanying them in their march, not even noting anything down. Some days it was just that. So that's what it meant. Like, that's what my day would look like. But I often didn't have an agenda that today I'll collect two interviews or today I'll collect an interview. It just meant jumping on opportunities. Like whenever you have the time, you would just like get your phone out and quickly record. But it meant being on the road a lot. It meant being in open spaces a lot. Like, I don't remember I've had more than like 3 or 4 interviews in closed spaces. Every interview has been in a public space. Every interview has been on the road or on a site.
Was there any event or any kind of experience that particularly stood out to you or like that you can remember and that taught you something? Or
there were so many, like really, like the kindness of people in these spaces will astound you. I especially remember we had this recent protest against the Citizenship Act. And it's very famously been covered, and it's called the Shaheen Bagh movement. And I was just sitting there in the open space, and this one person I had been meaning to interview, they would just come up to me with this huge box of like pulao and rice, and they would just give it to me to eat. Or they would get me juice boxes from time to time. And these women had been on their feet from the morning. They managed childcare, and they still managed to extend these moments of care towards me, a complete stranger. And I think that stuck with me in the way that it made me want to be more and more accountable in the way I write about them. I cannot represent them wrong. Like, I cannot represent their struggles in any way that they would not want to. I mean, after that, I started, like, including this question, how would you like to be written about? And that also gave some interesting, like, insights where they would say, I would like to be written about like this, or I don't care, like, write however you want to, just share the story. That moment sort of brought that change, where I started asking them about it, because it just made that accountability so heavy for me.
And maybe as a last question, do you have a literature tip for people interested in the topic of your research, like a book you can really recommend or something similar?
So there is this new book by a historian, like an Indian historian, Romila Thapar, A Voices of Dissent. It's not very long and it's very, very accessible. It gives a historical account of various movements and social movements in India to the contemporary times, to the movement that I just talked about, the Shaheen Bagh movement. It will give you all a good non-Western insight into some social movements and how they function. And this would be especially interesting to everyone who works on religion, because historically in India, religion has played quite a huge role in the way that it's interacted with social movements. So if anyone is interested in the interaction of that, this would be a very nice book. Voices of Dissent by Romila Thapar.
Perfect. Is there anything else you would like to mention that so far you find important and it didn't come up so far?
I would say that people should find avenues of publicly sharing their research in a much more accessible way, especially as anthropologists, because a lot of what we do is very socially relevant. And as long as it stays in our academic silos, it doesn't work. It doesn't help anyone. It doesn't even help us, honestly, as academics, if it stays just amongst us. That's the only thing I think that I haven't said. Create accessible knowledge. It's helpful for your participants, for your co-producers, and for yourself as scholars. And that's it.
So thank you very much, Paridi, for this lovely little conversation here with Zetnopod.